Take me to a happy place where kittens bloom and flowers bloom. People get a decent say in what goes on when we legislate. We Kiwi and January ain't harms drawn by bureaucracy. Good jobs I'd cast aside in the name of false economy. Take me to a happy place. Take me to a happy place.
And you're on the Postman Show with Ben Vidgen, and it's on Travelling Around New Zealand doing Ben's NZ, and I've got all the way to Auckland after an amazing series of adventures, and I find myself staying for the last couple of days with Vinnie Eastwood, host of the Vinnie Eastwood Show and general chaser of scum baggery. Hi Vinnie, how are you doing?
Somewhat fabulous is my standard response, Ben.
I see. Hey look, thank you very much for putting me out the last couple of days. It's been quite a blast actually. It's been quite pleasant to actually kind of catch up with you and hang out in a semi-social capacity, as opposed to we're always sort of catching each other on doing appointments and sort of chasing our jobs, really.
Yeah, well, you know, when scumbaggery is your job, you find you can never do enough work.
Yeah, well, we obviously at the beginning of the week got quite busy with the old Banksy thing, which is where I basically caught up with you at the High Court. What date was that actually on?
That was on the 1st of August, I believe, 9 o'clock in the morning. John Banks's court date started to go for his sentencing, rather than just the conviction, which happened a few weeks earlier, which I didn't turn up for because it wasn't quite so much of a cause for celebration. The case itself was really important for me on a very personal level because I really love to expose scumbaggery, and yet no matter how much of it I expose, none of the scumbags ever seem to get convicted of said scumbaggery, and for the first time ever, or somebody actually did it. So I thought it was incumbent upon me to turn up there and film as much as I could to get the real information about the trial out to the public. And I think that's why I prioritised, unlike the rest of the media, interviewing Mr. McCready, which we sat down to and had a conversation with for a good 20 minutes.
So what kind of blew me away about that was, A, he's done a historic prosecution case, and they've sat around for, you know, 50 minutes doing their questions, but none of them have actually tried to pin him down to get him to come into the station for an after-news interview or arrange anything like that. He's a superly important case, and they don't think it's worth doing anything more than the same importance I'd give for the cat chased up the tree story.
You got to appeal to the lowest common denominator if they're your only audience, right. And let's face it, man, with an 8-second attention span, a 20-minute interview with Graham McCready on mainstream media ain't going to sell.
It's pretty amazing, though, because what he can say in 20 seconds is a lot of information. And one of the things he brought up was about the upcoming prosecutions against John Key. Again, we saw mainstream journalists basically saying, oh, I see you're wearing a suit today, Graham. I see, you know, what are you going to do now that you've won the case? You know, like, I saw them asking very insignificant questions, but they didn't say, Graham, why are you prosecuting John Keyes, and on what grounds do you think you can possibly achieve that?
It's kind of like a trivium. It's an element that has an ability to bond with other elements and make them not matter anymore. No. And that's kind of what the mainstream media are constructed out of, a core nougat of trivium.
I mean, you know, this guy has just brought down a cabinet minister. They can't dismiss him because he's, in a court of law, actually proved himself now to be a credible person, and that charge is bomb. And lo and behold, nobody stops to say, well, what are these new important charges? You know, you've proved that you can bring down a minister.
Are the media afraid? Because I was thinking about this just the other day. As an interviewer myself, I understand what side my bread is buttered on. So when I go up against activists or something who I respect on a number of levels and want to get interviews with, I'll often save my criticism of them and I'll save the hard questions and then just try to listen to them. With Banksy, I don't do that kind of thing because he's not somebody who I really want to interview. He's not somebody who would give any decent information that's worthy of the public hearing because it's all lies and scumbaggery and deception and useless filth. So what I do is very, very different to the mainstream media. Yeah. I ask important questions and I actually wait around to listen to them. That media scrum was, you're wearing a suit today, what are you doing after this? And That was basically about it. It's about attire and partying after the fact. There's no evidence being discussed.
Well, Fairfax Media turned around an hour after that sentence was done and they had up on their website a paragraph devoted to the conviction, and they basically said that John Banks now had compelling evidence that was going to overturn this. So their whole focus was on this compelling evidence that John Banks said that he had, without any supporting evidence or any evidence to corroborate that he actually has this or that it's irrelevant as he says it is. No mention of any of the other case points and no mention of the fact that Graham McCreedy has now launched a prosecution against the Prime Minister.
Yeah, it just avoids the issues. And basically what the reader will come across with is, okay, he's been convicted, okay, he's been sentenced, but he's got all this evidence that exonerates him, so therefore the conviction and the sentence didn't happen, right? Is that the intention here? It kind of seems like the kind of thing a whole bunch of brain-dead pieces of trash who have nothing but the establishment on the back of their mind and supporting their own slavery system. They'd very much easily swallow that because at the end of the day, having your heroes fall off a pedestal and you being the stupid person who put them up there in the first place, you get crushed. So I think what these people are doing is getting out of the way of their tumbling hero so that they don't get their egos crushed along with his career.
Pretty much all. But you know, you look at all the mitigating circumstances that originally they started off with, saying that they're going to give 4 months worth of, it's equivalent of 4 months jail sentence. And then they turn around and they say, well, we're going to do this because you've got no prior blot on your copybook, you know, so you're not likely to do this again. When factually, we know this is not actually correct. John Banks does have a prosecution, which you cover when you're chasing down the street with a bullhorn.
Well, he even admitted to the North Shore Police that he asked for the checks to be split and then maintains his innocence afterwards in complete contradiction with his own admissions, which the police, for some reason, aren't really hoping to try and hold up and go, actually, he admitted he was a criminal, you know. Why not? Is it because he was a former police commissioner? Is it because they're ACT Party voters? Is it because they're simply corrupt sociopathic scum that he's capable of blackmailing if they were ever to cross him? Who knows?
So you got that fact that they didn't mention the fact that he actually has a prior conviction, and then they turn around and they say he's got all this good community service without going into the reality is that everything John Banks did was about building a political career. He didn't do anything out of personal, he's a nice guy. He did it because he's trying to build himself a power base. And what their version of service is incredibly subjective, and they never put that out to public debate to say, well, you know, did John Banks actually give this country good service? Because many people in this country say that repeatedly he has a history of actually thwarting justice.
Yeah, I suppose that's the way of things in the upper echelons in the New Zealand police. The guys on the street that I speak to, even detectives, sergeants, etc., a lot of them know what's going on within the police in terms of corruption and deception, etc., because as we all know, a lot of laws, like say, just for example, cannabis laws, are based on a lie. And so in order to enforce a law that's based on a lie, don't you have to be taught how to lie? Right? So it becomes to a point where those who are supposed to inflict justice upon the corrupt and the deceptive are in fact trained to be corrupt and deceptive in order to do so.
Well, then we get to the tricky one, which is really hard to cover, is the fact of his little lapel on his badge. And, you know, the hard thing about covering about something is that we saw this firsthand. We were there, and you can't dismiss it, but to write about it, people immediately are conspiracy theory. And I'm talking, of course, the fact that when he went to court, he's wearing that badge with the Knights Templars of the...
Actually, we did a little bit more research into it. It is a former Templar badge, but it's not a Knights Templar. It's a what they call Gnostic Templars. The Gnostic Templar website says they have a 5-point plan for bringing about a one-world spirituality. Now, for me, that kind of seems like a satanic way of bringing about a one-world religion. Just based upon my occult studies, interviewing high-level Freemason whistleblowers, people who've been in multiple secret societies are operating at very high levels, and that's what they say is all about.
But
and
just step back, the very fact that you have a secret society operating in broad daylight, the television cameras all around, that guy's wearing that badge, and it's right there for you people to see that it's actually, you know, this is not people just making it up. It's go look at the film footage, he's wearing that fucking badge, and that's basically saying to the judge, I'm one of you. Go lightly on me.
I'm a protected species. Yeah. Now, if Banksy were to give the finger to the camera, everybody would know what that symbol means. Yeah. It means F you.
Yeah.
But if he wears a lapel on his badge that is connected to a secret society that has a public admission statement of undermining all forms of religious belief in order to replace it with their own, nobody knows that symbol.
Because we all walk into court wearing those, of course. You know, everybody wears it. It makes total sense. The mayor of Auckland is going to be wearing a secret society badge.
He's one of the most well-known high-level Freemasons in the country. The thing about the sect of Freemasonry is they have a whole lot of side subset groups, Shriners, Rosicrucians, and a number of other things. And it's sort of like when you go to university and you get like your bachelor's degree and your master's and your PhD, and then you belong to the chess club and the math club and the debate club and all of that kind of stuff.
It's the same thing.
Secret
really.
Societies work in that same kind of feather in the cap, little badge
and exactly, to demystify it, in some ways that's the way to actually look at it, which is like, it's so what it's a Masons or so what if it's a Boy Scout, it's just a badge, but it's still saying I'm a part of this elite circle, so I get privileges. And this goes back to the issue of sentencing too, because again, it's like, hey, when you were minister, he got great perks. So shouldn't with great office come great responsibility, which means that when you do go down, it should even be harder, not less.
Well, I think great power comes without great accountability, because naturally you can thwart the course of justice by using your power. I mean, did I miss something? That powerful people have managed to cover up and prevent themselves being brought to justice because they're powerful? Is anybody freaking home in this country?
This is a situation when you look at it, when you're standing there in the courtroom and you've got guys wandering in with these, basically wearing a school tie, an old boys network tie, and they're going out in front of these camera people who are all wearing basically yuppie suits and Prada, and the best questions they can come up with is, are you going to do your laundry tonight? I mean, you just see it firsthand how absolutely corrupt the whole system is.
When I interviewed Ian Wishart, I mean, I know we got mixed views about him, but the thing that he told me about the media when he was working there at the high level on the Sunday program, he just said, they're airheads. Alright, basically, here's the deal. Have you got a whole bunch of really stupid, ignorant people that watch television for about 6 to 8 hours a night after coming out of school, so they've never actually had to learn how to think for themselves or be completely independent in that vein of thing? Why, yes, you do. Well, how exactly would you appeal to those people? Oh my god, you get somebody who's just like them. Somebody who has uncultured, unintelligent, uncurious, and totally ignorant. And voila, you have a great little feedback loop. So the ignorance of the public gets fed by the ignorance of the reporters, and the ignorance of the reporters gets fed back into the public, and back it comes again. Not only do the reporters have to lie to you, but the public actually learns to love to be suckered. I mean, is that not self-evident? It's a very depressing worldview, I'm sure, but at the end of the day, it's a numbers game. And when I look at, everybody talks about like the revolution, when's the revolution going to happen? Personally, revolution by definition means to go in a frickin' circle. I'm not really interested in that. And what people aren't talking about is what would happen after the revolution. What kind of society will we be getting up? Let's have a look at some of these elements of corruption and use the Banks case as a case study, exactly how you could prevent this kind of thing from happening. Well, first of all, secret society membership seems to get you a little bit of extra power. So maybe secret societies shouldn't be quite as secret as they are, or maybe people within them should not be considered as a protected species. They have these blanketed things that say we don't debate politics in the lodge and things like that, but these people meet up in the lodge, they talk about politics outside of it, and they are sworn to protect each other as brothers. And in the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, which is what Banksy belongs to, there is no code of conduct of moral retribution. For example, you're not allowed to criticize or reveal information, even if it's against the law, about the lodge. Previously, they did have that kind of regulation, but it's been removed. So if you're a Mason right now and you're listening to this and you've seen something corrupt in the lodge and you've tried to bring it to your lodge master and you say, hey, this guy's doing this, that, and the other, and the lodge master tells you to sit down and shut up, now you know why, because you're not allowed to. So there's something you've got to really look into. Should being part of a secret society disallow you from entering public service?
Well, they had a case in England where they went through all the stuff in the 80s, so the John Stalker affair, and the end result was that they actually outlawed, if you were a police officer, you weren't allowed to be a member of the Freemasonry organisation.
And incidentally, now, even still today, that didn't work, because 30% of the UK officers are allegedly Freemasons. And it's happened quite a number of times. Friends of mine, activists in Britain, would be out protesting, and cops would come up to them, and they'd notice that these guys are wearing a Masonic ring. You know? And it's sort of like a world within a world you don't notice.
Yeah.
Okay?
It's around us all the time.
Yeah, and the thing is, we're not familiar with the symbolism, we're not familiar with the gusto, we're not familiar with the keywords and things like that. So let's say, for instance, you were to do a subject analysis of socialism, you know, Trotskyism, Marxism, Leninism, and all the other Stalinist type of aspects of it. And then you think about all of these things that they have in common. Well, they slaughter huge amounts of people, they take away freedoms, they bankrupt the countries, they basically destroy society. And then you have a look at those simple methodologies, the little words that they use in their speeches, the little wording in their legislation and things like that. And then you can start to apply those models onto others. You can see where the corruption is by noticing these little quote-unquote red flags, pun intended. Now, in terms of secret societies, it's not quite as well known as socialism. And more to the point, there's a blanket of straight denial of merely the existence of the possibility of corruption in secret societies. All right. Now, there's something to be said about compartmentalization. If you are a person working at KFC, how long do you think you have to be working at KFC before they tell you what the secret ingredient in the chicken is? The answer is they never tell you. Who knows if the CEO even knows it? So who the hell knows what the secret ingredient is whatsoever? Mm. And that same kind of corporate secrecy can be applied to nearly any single section of society that you look at, whether it's the head of a political party, CEO of Greenpeace, goodness knows who, goodness knows what. We have no idea, even if we're working in said organizations, what those organizations are really about until we're at the top level. And you don't attain the top level without learning over a long period of time what to say in order to get brownie points and what you don't say if you don't want to get kicked out of any position of favoritism within that group that you're a part of. So it forces the silo mentality to come out in full strength, and it prevents people from basically telling the truth. Not entirely dissimilar to how political correctness is part of an agenda to stop people from just saying what they think anymore. How do you think all these political parties have always, you know, gone against their word and everything like that? Don't you think there'd be a whole bunch of people within those political parties say, hey, we actually promised this, it was part of our policy, why aren't you delivering on it? No, they don't say that, because if they do, you're out of the party, mate. You're going to resign your ministerial portfolio.
Looks like that.
You're going to be a backbencher. Things like that happened to, say, Horne Harawira when he was... Who was it? The late Vape Kupinga, my auntie Vape, told me that Horne was kicked out of the Māori Party because of the climate change, ETS, and all of that sort of stuff. Because he thought that it would actually really hit the poorest the hardest by making everything that they would ever buy or use...
And he's right.
...more expensive. You know? And they kicked him out of the party because of it. That's what, that was the birth of mana. So here's the thing, it's kind of like you're either prepared to tell the truth, and as a result you have to work 10 times as hard to create your own party, and then you have the same problems coming back in on you again, just like Horne Harawira did, just like Winston Peters did, or Jim Anderton, the ACT party. All of these other little minor parties often wind up being started and carried on by people who had disagreements with the larger parties that they previously were members of. And that's kind of like a really good thing, but also at the same time they're simply replicating that exact design flaw, but just their version of it. And it occurs to me that this is the reason why political change doesn't happen in New Zealand. It just doesn't.
Just going back to the positive side, like, you know, I mean, I know it was a small victory, but, like, you know, there's two ways to look at Graham McCurdy's one, which is, one is, well, a small victory, but it's a victory. Take it, accept it, and realise we made one step forward. Well, the other way is to realise that it was a small victory, but it's nowhere enough, and we really sit back and think that that's, you know, that's made a difference. You've got two camps. You look at this situation from, what do you think?
Well, I think one of those camps is surrounded by palisades, and it's unassailable, and that's the camp that says this is the first step, as Mr. McCready said. And it occurs to me that when you're in, say, a boxing match or something like that, suddenly when your opponent's on the ropes, do you step back and go, haha, he's on the ropes? Or do you step in closer and keep slamming him and slamming him and slamming him until he's down for the count? this is what we need to do. We need to hose in. I have been vigorously throwing it all out on Facebook, everywhere I can, trying to get people to watch the videos of the interview with Graham McCready and the chasing John Banks down the road with a megaphone and what have you, because A, it's really funny, and B, it's really informative, and C, it's really scary. So if it's funny, informative, and scary at the same time, I think it actually creates a brain chemistry mix-up, which makes you really informed, really cynical, and also really happy.
Odd mixture.
Yeah. I'm a man who loves irony because I see it all the time around me, kind of like oil products.
Yeah. So the loony world that we're actually living in, that's the thing. I mean, you know, it's like being in Northam for 5 days. I get to Auckland and it's just this concrete jungle and neon lights everywhere, and what people are ascribing to is considered important and valuable. It's just so paradox of what I've witnessed the last 5 days. And that seems like a much more sane, peaceful way to live. Whereas this just seems about rampant consumption.
Yeah, it's kind of like the grass is always greener on the other side. I've got this great epic rant on YouTube where I talk about the average day in the life of a truther. Yeah. You know, for other people, the day and the recounting of it is something along the lines of I got up, I had breakfast, I went to work, I had lunch, I came home from work, and then I had dinner and I watched some TV and I went to sleep. And it seems pretty easy. It seems pretty simple, right?
Yeah.
But for somebody like me, the thing that wakes you up is a stress response that kicks your adrenal glands into action from the loud noise of the alarm, which mimics the action of being violently shaken awake, which disturbs your sleep pattern and starts you off on your day on a stress on a stressful path. And then you put on your slippers that are made by some description of sweatshop in India, and then you go into your bathroom or something like that, and you take a wiki leak, and then you flush it down, and it goes into a sewage treatment plant or something of that nature, and all the chemicals and everything in my blood
are
always...
You don't really care because you're just average person.
Oh no, I do know and I do care, and that's the real problem here. Ultimately, the people who are completely ignorant of what's going on in this world and the reality of anything that they do are living in that semi sort of blissful ignorance. However, ignorance can still kill you, just as surely as being stressed out about the things you know can kill you. And I think about this like somebody who's worried about, say, Fukushima radiation will sit there and worry about Fukushima radiation. And because they're worried about it, it releases a whole bunch of stress hormones into the body, and it starts eating away their muscle tissue, and it also puts extra strain on the heart and starts to hollow out the valves, and you can actually give yourself a stroke and a heart attack by worrying about radiation giving you cancer. Right? So this is the way that ignorance can be used. Now, I'm kind of trying to, in keeping with my irony theme, talk about a way of knowing what's going on, but also taking what's useful from that information and discarding what's frightening or stressful about it in an attempt to live a comfortable life. I mean, just because I'm being ruthlessly exterminated by a bunch of criminal sociopathic scum doesn't mean I can't have a few laughs about it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, let's face it, it's just the end of the world.
Imagine.
Yeah. And it's in this dark kind of gallows humor realm that I dwell, but at the same time, I'm not like somebody who's a talk radio show host over here or a comedian over here. I'm kind of like a mixture of the both. So I'm not entirely credible, much like a comedian who just kind of like hyperbolizes things in order for a comedic effect, but I'm also like a talk radio show host in the fact that I'm giving information.
But you're talking about the other night, you're saying it was like, well, you said you're watching Graham Norton thinking, hey, that's what I do, and that's basically what you do. You bring people actually on from different backgrounds and get them relaxed and let them rip. And you do, you have such a wide eclectic, you have everybody on the show. You don't pretty much care what the, as long as they've got something elegant to say and that they can back up their position for an hour, you'll let them do it.
Yeah, well, even if they can't back it up, sometimes it's fun to just hear them out, you know what I'm saying? The real important thing about what I do, or at least the thing that I find is most important about it, is survival. Okay, I've recognized that stress is a killer, and when I went through this transition going from, yes, officer, yes, I've got 3 bags of weed, yes, I've been selling marijuana for 8 months, officer, yes, I'll sign that confession, going from that kind of point of absolute ignorance about how the system treats people to the bold-faced lying and the horrific stress of being arrested when I was 19, it kind of occurred to me that comedy is a survival mechanism. You know, it truly is. And most of us, to a large extent, or at least a lot of people who learn about conspiracy, scumbaggery, and even some people just about alternative health, they have a blocker And that block is there for a good reason. It's a survival response, so that when you're being chased by a tiger or something like that, you don't crumple down on your knees and start crying because your daddy used to hit you when you were small and he never loved you, you know. Your brain automatically puts that stuff behind you.
Yeah.
But what's problematic is that it doesn't just put it behind you and leave it behind you. It puts it behind you and sticks it in the back of your mind so that it's constantly eating away at your sanity. And in order to combat this whole understanding of how the world really works and how evil the system is, I mean, to even comprehend 0.1% of one item of scumbaggery or one conspiracy is an intensely traumatic affair. It seems to me that this kind of coping mechanism of laughter is so important, which is why it is quite rare to see a whole lot of humor in the news. It's very dry, it's very surfacey or shallow. It's not witty. Occasionally they come up with really crappy puns. For example, they would do quote unquote a crappy headline, and the story would be about a sewage pipe that burst down on a beach or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean,
Florida has a crappy day. Yeah.
We're really scraping the bottom of the barrel here, bro. And it occurs to me that there's two types of reporters in there. Those who really want to report the truth, regardless of the consequences, and those who really just want to collect the paycheck and go on those trips to Tahiti at the end of the year, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So on that note, you're on the postal show, we're going to take a wee break now. You're on the Postman Show. Is this Postman Show, not the Vinnie Eastwood Show? Because it seems to be confusing, because we had as our guest on today, Vinnie Eastwood, and as all DJs do, they always sign off, which is what happened last time. So you're actually on the Postman Show. You sure about that now, Vinnie?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just forgot about it, you know.
What I'm sort of keep coming back to is trying to highlight the empowerment value of what basically happened with Graham McCready, and basically what you'll do with what you're doing as well, and covering that particular case. Like, the reality is that we saw the mainstream media turn up, cover it, and they gave us basically 5 seconds of every minute that they were there. That's all they got. People got the highlights of the highlights, and it was slanted to say a message which didn't even reflect. I mean, it was like, you know, what we've seen was nowhere reflective of what actually happened on that day. You'll do your show, and when you put your up on YouTube clips, you know, it's getting good hits, and that's what people are becoming more and more aware of. They're not going to mainstream news for the media source. They are actually now starting to go and source out themselves.
Well, starting is nowhere near enough. I mean, I admit that I've got a little bit of narcissistic tendency about me, so I am a bit of an attention seeker. But I'm a believer in doing good things for evil personal reasons rather than evil things for good reasons. You know what I'm saying? Like, for example, I'm an attention seeker, and I want people to look at me. So what I do is I find this really famous guy who has actually done something really, really important, and I sit down him in front of him, and I ask him to tell the audience and me about who he really is and how he actually got into this situation. And to explain his entire backstory and try to relay emotional empathy with him, so and some form of encouragement, and tell a few jokes and make sure he has a good time. And I've done this with a lot of activists who were under incredibly stressful situations, whether that be via government, family, or financial stress, etc. And on a number of occasions, they've later commented that if it wasn't for me, literally, if it wasn't for me at that time, giving them that encouragement, letting them be heard for the first time ever in some cases, they would have given up what they were doing. Right? And so this is doing a good thing for my evil personal reasons. You see what I'm saying? This is again part of my main theme of irony. And it stems from my intense sort of self-analysis as a narcissist. You think about yourself and you love yourself quite a lot. And so I think about how I fit in, how I can do the most good with these evil things that are in my head and how I can twist them and distort my natural tendencies in order to do the opposite for what my brain's telling me to do. And this is why I don't want to be in parliament or in charge of really powerful corporations or anything, because I'd wind up abusing my authority, right? I know my personality type. That's what I would do. And that's why I go into these situations with activists with total honesty and being really genuine. Because if I go in playing my cards close to my chest, it's like I'm trying to hold power back, or I'm trying to hold something back from these people who I'm trying to open up. And it doesn't work that way, okay? If you're really open, they'll automatically mirror your behaviors, and then they'll be really open. Okay, so I've managed to turn what's basically an inherently bad thing that I see in myself into something that can be used for positive reasons, much like using a rifle to defend the innocent rather than kill them.
That's a correct one. Well, it's a means of looking at it.
If you don't analyze your own behavior and sort of like blow it out of proportion and make it appear worse than it actually is, sometimes you actually become worse than you think you are.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a philosopher, and he, R-A-W are his initials. I forget his name. He did a great quote. It's the Ballad of the Cosmic Schmuck. Cosmic meaning big, schmuck meaning idiot for the uninitiated. How do I know if I'm the cosmic schmuck? If I never question... If I never stop back one time and just think to myself, you know, put my hands on my beard and scratch it for a second and go, am I the cosmic schmuck? If you never do that...
You're the cosmic schmuck.
Exactly. And it seems to me that the worse I view myself... Ironically, the better I feel, because it means that I'm capable of dealing with the reality of the things that are within me, my negativity, my anger, my insecurities, me being overweight and what have you. Again, just like the comedy, it's a survival mechanism. And everybody naturally does this. We overcompensate for the things that that we're not good at. Sort of like you've got a really, really strong left brain, so your right brain becomes very, very weak, and you don't do training exercises to balance those out generally. What you do is you just keep focusing on your strong left brain. You get really, really good at it. And I think developing a skill for it, I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to be using it for in the future, but...
Evil, no doubt.
Well, this is the reason why most of my friends and the people I consider my close confidants, I seek their counsel, obviously, especially when I'm confused about things, which happens on occasion. And also, a lot of these people expose scumbaggery for a living. And this is the reason why I remain close to them, is because I want them to also, by proxy, keep checks and balances on me. Because if I were to stop... exposing scumbaggery and become part of it, the thing that I would hope would happen the fastest as possible is everybody who I've ever helped ever who exposes scumbaggery for a living would turn on me, tear me to shreds, destroy my audience, destroy my credibility, so they couldn't do that harm. You see what I'm saying? I'm kind of like a somebody voluntarily checking themselves into a mental asylum because they know that they're dangerous. I know that I'm dangerous. I know that I'm unemployable. But I also know that I can really use all of these skills and abilities to help people who can't help themselves in a lot of ways. Almost all the activists that I know don't have the basic skills that are necessary to film, edit, upload, and promote their stuff on YouTube. You know, those are some very basic skills where I can either teach for people or I can just do it for them. Most of the time, I just do it for them because they're doing the what I consider, quote-unquote, the real important work, okay? So, for example, let's take this in context of the Graham McCready case. Who did the real important work there? Was it me who interviewed him, or was it him who did the case? It was him who did it. Okay, so he actually did the real thing. He did the documents.
Penny Albright as well, who was completely basically written out of this and narrated by the media.
Yeah.
I don't even really know what her role in this is.
Penny is the ultimate Bush lawyer. So pretty much, if it comes to preparing documents in a proper way, if it comes to summing up things, spreadsheets, facts, bullet points, etc., judicial wrap-ups, whatever, she's the woman you go to if you don't have the money to pay somebody to do it, you know? And Penny will do it because she's like me. She's figured out that she's capable of surviving on very little, but actually devoting the vast majority of her personal time to exposing scumbaggery and being particularly effective at it. And her methodologies are really great because she's been being in activism for about 30 odd years, maybe 40 at this point. And
she's formidable.
Yeah, I mean, she's kind of like the woman that you don't want to mess with, and for very good reason. Yeah. Like, I considered myself a bit of a chauvinist back in the day, but since... But
she reminds me that I am a chauvinist. Yeah. It's like, thank you, Penny.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is sort of like, I used to sort of have very little respect for women to a large degree. And then I realised that there are actually some women out there that are so powerful and so formidable and so worthy of my respect as a man that I abandoned my belief structures. And Penny Bright's one of those women. Grace Hayden's another. Nicola, she's a private prosecutor, private detective. Who used to be working for the New Zealand Police, 15-year prosecuting sergeant. Famous quote from her is, "The New Zealand Police are so corrupt, you either become corrupted or you leave." And I left, you know. And it occurs to me that it's not a male or a female thing. It's an honour thing.
Yeah.
It's a moral obligation thing that drives these people.
Uh-huh.
And that's something that... really struck me in the interview we did with Graham McCready is his entire reason for doing this is, "I've always been doing it, I've always been needed," you know. And I said to him something I've said many times before: he who has the ability has the responsibility. Who else but Graham McCready had the ability to prosecute John Banks and get him convicted? Nobody. Okay, who else had the ability but Graham McCready to fashion up a whole bunch of evidence and go after the Prime Minister directly after convicting John Banks? Nobody. All right, it's a team effort, but at the end of the day, I call it the A team effect, where you have a group of individuals who have an eclectic skill base, who are specialists in their fields, who have very little in common other than central objectives. Because of their eclectic skill base and their various experiences, they're capable of coming together to accomplish and pull off missions of action that others consider to be either insane or impossible. I mean, I could just think about Penny Bright as B.A. Baracus, you know.
I love it when a plan comes together. Chomping on a cigar. I can see that.
See, we really do have to get Monroy to do a Photoshop version of the A-team and have Graham McCready and all the activist team and everything that came together to bring down Banksy, you know. Life's real funny and strange like that, isn't it interesting that John's last name is Banks?
I thought that was great. The irony of it is just brilliant. It's like,
I mean, what does everybody hate and is currently in debt to? Banks. And yet, a whole bunch of people stick up for them. I don't get it. And there was one particular dude there at the thing, and he was almost as tall as me, which is very rare. You know, I'm 6 foot four. To see somebody, anybody, anywhere near the same height as me is quite rare. And this guy was one of Banksy's supporters. And just like a Banksy supporter, vicious, arrogant, up himself, for lack of a better word, wankery. And it occurred to me that this is sort of like the only base of support that these people like Banksy have.
But I think I met the same guy in the elevator, and it was going down the elevator. I took the opportunity because I sort of figured he was a legal type, and I sort of went, I said, "You know, I'm just kind of curious, got one question, you know, about the legal proceedings about this." "Oh, yes, what's that?" I said, "Well, didn't John Banks actually have a prior conviction, and shouldn't that have been taken in the migrating circumstances, along with the fact that he refused to acknowledge that he actually conducted a crime? So, in other words, there was no sign of remorse. So, the comments about the parole officer saying that, you know, he wasn't likely to offend, that's nonsense because he hadn't actually acknowledged the crime. So, that coincided with his prior history or conviction should have been taken, you know, that should have been included in sentencing, but as it is with the other case. But it wasn't this one." And the guy went, "No, that's not correct." But it was like one of those, no, not I'm arguing from fact, but if I just say it loudly enough, then it becomes a fact.
Yeah. And repeat it often enough. Yeah. All right. For example, John Banks repeated the fact, we have some new, fresh, watertight, unimpeachable, new, watertight, fresh, unimpeachable evidence. And I am innocent of this crime, and it will exonerate me. And I am innocent of this crime, and it will exonerate me. Repeat.
Yeah.
Back, reinforce. Okay, yeah. It's quite...
And then an hour later, that's what they were reporting on New Zealand Herald.
Hello!
Yeah.
Okay, because they all want... All these reporters...
I think that even... It was the headline. Actually, I can't remember the exact headline, but the headline reflected this John Banks is not guilty status, you know?
Yeah. I actually want to try and refrain from criticising the media a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Because I think to myself, well, if I'm nasty to them and what have you, how likely are they to ever come and give me any coverage or whatever, right?
Well, I think that's very important, true.
And also, at the same time, if I'm not nasty enough to them, will my audience kind of go, Vinny, you're being limp, you know? Because I'm just thinking about this. How do we really approach this? I mean... Because you can't go to the media and say you're a douchebag through the megaphone and have them actually listen to you and change the way that they report on things. I've also noticed that you can't go to them with credible information that has evidence and documents that is actually very damaging to any government agenda or government official, because they won't report it, because if they do report it, that government official won't ever give them an interview again. So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Yeah, but a couple of things stop you there, because first of all, Graham McCready turned around and he made a point to thank the media, and I think he's actually quite correct to do so. And the end result was just his personality. I mean, whatever questions they asked of him, you could see that they have a sympathy towards him, and that'll be useful for him for the future. So he's been a smart strategist on that level. And I think also, I mean, the aspect about the media is like, you know, I find them, I've done my book, Ben ZNZ. Now, I haven't talked to them about politics, but I've talked to them about how great Ragland is or whatever. They've given me that media spotlight on me, which means at least now that I've got a chance to have a spotlight on me, I can then talk about other subjects as well. But as long as I keep my relationship with the media on a neutral basis, then they're quite happy to interact. It's only when I start talking politics that they clam up. So just, you know.
I've been trying to do that myself a little bit. Now, media reporters have come to me, and I've been in the Waikato Herald, and I've been in the Western Leader here in West Auckland. And when the guys came in, I was kind to them, you know, I made them a coffee and gave them some fresh organic shop water, and we talk, we had a laugh, we have a good time, and that kind of thing, because they're there to interview me. I'm not going to be adversarial or anything like that. And basically, I can be pretty freaking smooth and charming when I need to be. However, because I'm an inherently angry young man, when I see the ineptitude, when I see the sort of betrayal to the membership characteristics of being part of the Fourth Estate Club.
Yeah, it's an abusive privilege, and it's a hard one it's like, hey man, you guys got all this resources and you could be doing really good, amazing stuff with that, you know, and you won't because you just want the $75,000 fucking
house. But you can't say that to them.
No, you aren't.
Because that's like, if one of them was to come to me and say, Vinny, you know, if you stop talking about all this conspiracy stuff, you could be a really famous radio show host and stuff like that. And I say, well, I can't do that because it's the truth, unfortunately. It's almost like sometimes you learn, particularly as you get older, when you get out of the early frontal lobe development, you begin to control your reactions a lot more steadily, and you begin to think about things before you say them. Because often, one thing that you say, even if you apologize and even if you retract it, will damage you forever in the mind of the person you said it to. Even if you say, oh, I'm sorry, I just had a fight or flight reptilian brain response, and I slashed out at you verbally without thinking, that kind of thing. I'm very, very sorry. They accept your apology and then never talk to you again. There's the other element of the equation per negotiating, being friendly with and supporting in whatever minimalistic capacity you can, the media and vice versa. There's the war element, okay, as in their competition, and and I am at war with them. Now, what does war get you other than debt and casualties? Not a whole lot.
There is an interesting point there, because I mean, you know, like, okay, so what, they turn around and denounce, of course, the conspiracy theories, all you do. I mean, it's that old thing of like, I mean, I didn't grow up to be one, you know, I didn't spend all the time and energy to grow up so it'd be like, people, oh, look, there's a conspiracy theorist. You know, that wasn't what I wanted to have on my fucking CV, but I want to get my message actually out. So ultimately, at the end of the day, they want to call me a conspiracy theorist, but they're still writing Google hits and posting or whatever. It's all fucking getting my advertising. More people are coming to people like us who are actually seeking news than going to people like them. They're largely making themselves redundant, and increasingly I think people just don't believe what they watch in the mainstream media.
Well, do they believe in themselves? See, and again, back to the cosmic schmuck arguments. Yeah. These mainstream media people, like me, and that they're flagrantly narcissistic and totally full of themselves, but they don't realise it, you know?
Yeah.
I realise my flaws and my character weaknesses, and I take mitigating steps in order to minimise the amount of damage and harm that I can do to other people. Do these people do that if they have the same afflictions?
Well, I mean, I haven't worked that deep in the corporate media. I've sort of come around the edges of it. But from where I've stood, you know, I've seen people that are actually quite pleasantly unhappy people that are going to great lengths to climb this ladder and happy to don't mind who they butcher along the way. And I think, yeah, I mean, it creates a type of person that is common to that media format that you won't find in fringe media or alternative media. I mean, you know, the people out here aren't doing it, really doing it for fame, glory and fortune. They're doing it because it's the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were doing it because they wanted a vote. If I was doing it because I wanted a brand new Ferrari, well, I'd be doing a completely different kind of media and would involve tits and fucking ass, you know? But the reality is, I'm not out of it for the fucking money. I'm out of it because I actually believe these stories need to be put forth.
But surely your publication could do with a little bit of tits and ass here or there, you know, just in between the folds of the pages.
Well, it's actually a really interesting point, because I actually personally think, yes, I think there's nothing wrong with fucking sex at all, and I'm pissed off the way we have such a hypocritical standard to sex. It's like, we can have entertainment of people shooting and blowing each other left, right and centre, that's totally okay. But, oh no, you show tits and boobs. Oh, it's like, what? So, you know, the reality is, that's quite interesting, because you do put that stuff actually out there, even if, because, you know, I do newspapers which include cafes and all sorts of other lifestyle. Why not? Why not have sex? I'm into sex, so why shouldn't I reflect? This is, I know there's people out there that think, say, oh no, you can't have that. That's belittling woman. That's, you know, it's been cheapening the truth movement or whatever, you know. It's like, so says who?
Well, what they're doing is they're applying a thought process that they might have and they saw in somebody else back in the day, and then they say that you're the exact same person that I've seen before. And it's just simply not true, because the things that you've seen before don't always repeat the exact same patterns, the exact way you've seen them before. There's often little differences. Like I always say, it's not the big crazy things in your life that'll drive you nuts. It's the little things, like your shoelaces getting caught in your bicycle or something like that, or dropping a cup in the kitchen when you'd just gotten home from work and you badly needed a coffee or something like that. And so
or putting salt and baking powder. All right, well, look, thank you very much, Vinny. You've been on The Postman Show, and good night and good luck.
And also, remember to check out my website at The Vinny Eastwood Show.
Sorry.
That's The Vinny Eastwood Show.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood isn't go ahead, make my news. And you can also search Vinny Eastwood or Mr. News, MR News, on YouTube to find my YouTube channel. There's more archives on there of long-form interviews and information than anybody else in New Zealand history has ever made, and I have more subscribers than the New Zealand Herald, and I've accomplished that largely alone. So if anybody else out there wants to get into alternative media, just believe me when I tell you, be full of yourself, don't give up, and totally, totally expose scumbaggery. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vinny. Good night. Good luck.